Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham, episode 259, After Sandlwana and Rorke's Drift, Ghost Armies, an Unspoken Truce During a Savage War. It's the 23rd of January, 1879. One of the most momentous days in South African history has passed, and the ripple effect will be felt across the world. For missionary Otto Witt, it was a time of particular terror. He had fled his mission station, Rorke's Drift, and now it was smashed to bits. The house, which had doubled up as a hospital, burned to the ground. The main warehouse, which had been his church, broken and bloody. Witt had fled the day before and sought out his wife and children, who he'd sent on to Msinga. Once it became apparent the British were going to invade Zululand. Witt had lost his way up the Biggersburg Escarpment on the terrifying night of the 22nd of January, and he staggered into the Gordon Memorial Mission at Msinga the next morning, but his wife, Ellen, and their three young children had already left. He didn't know this, merely that she wasn't there. Ellen had been told by refugees streaming away from Sandlwana that Otto had been killed at Rorke's Drift, so both now believed the other dead. The family spent 5 days believing they were widows and widowers. The confusion was only cleared up when Witt finally tracked Erin's wagon trail to Pietermaritzburg, where the family was reunited, exhausted and traumatized, but physically unharmed. In Newcastle, Maud Bradstreet had just assisted her friend Mrs. Hitchcock in delivering a baby girl named Georgina. Their joy was short-lived, however, as news arrived that the Newcastle Mounted Rifles had been decimated at Sandlwana, both of their husbands among the dead. The two women set out for the Orange Free State, a grueling, week-long journey by horse and cart, surviving on very little except water strained through a mini-bag. This was the raw reality for the survivors. Later in the episode, we'll hear from the Zulu. On the morning of January 23rd, a messenger reached Hulp Mekaar with a brief note from Lieutenant Chard, Rorke's Drift commander. Defying the grim expectations of the men at the camp, they had miraculously held their ground through the night. Back at Sandlwana, Chelmsford had awoken his men and rode away from the scene of carnage before dawn. One of the men had found the mangled body of Lieutenant Colonel Pullain, Sandlwana's commanding officer. Then the column passed down Manzimyama Valley. They moved past homesteads that had been abandoned only a day prior, but now the inhabitants were creeping back. Through the doorway of a single hut, they saw Nanyanga tending to Amakungubeni warriors who had fought at Sandlwana. The tension snapped. Soldiers of the Natal native contingent opened fire and killed a man before order could be restored. A seething anger swirled through the British column. Trooper Fred Jones, one of the survivors of the Newcastle Mounted Rifles, was not in a forgiving mood. "We saw red," he admitted. Here and there, the mounted vedettes came across Zulu stragglers making their way back from Sandlwana and Rorke's Drift and shot them down without quarter. Later, larger groups of warriors could be seen emerging from the direction of the Imzinyati River. Some of Chelmsford's men thought it was a trap, and Henry Finn recognized them by the shields and headrings. They were the Utulwana, returning from Rorke's Drift. Exhausted and broken, the warriors shuffled forward, dragging their shields in the dust. The Utulwana were stunned. They thought no British soldiers were left alive after Sandlwana. For a long, tense moment, the two forces stared at one another across a distance easily covered by a bullet. Yet neither side pulled a trigger. It was, as historian Ian Knight notes, a surreal conclusion to an extraordinary 48 hours, two armies both feeling the weight of defeat, watching each other move silently into the distance. Except for one Zulu warrior, as Lieutenant Maxwell of the NNC explained. "They appeared in some places not more than 250 yards from us. I was at this time in the vanguard, and suddenly, from the enemy on the ridge, they sprang out a young warrior to the front." The entire column could see this man waving his spear and musket venomously. "Who,
by his actions and speech, was endeavouring to urge the others to attack, said Maxwell. Failing in which, he madly rushed down the hillside towards the centre of the column and was shot dead at about 30 yards. Not a single fellow warrior followed him. They didn't even stand up, remaining on their haunches, watching him run, then fall, entirely unmoved. A strange dialogue opened up as the columns neared. The mounted police, fluent in isiZulu, exchanged choice insults with the wary warriors. The two forces moved along converging angles, passed within a stone's throw, and then slowly disappeared from each other's view. This remains a singular event in most military history, a moment where the shared trauma forced a truce that no general had ordered. Chelmsford still had no idea what had happened at Rorke's Drift. As his column approached, the smoke covered the buildings. They expected the worst, but soon they realized the men they saw moving about there were British. When they arrived, everything smelt of fire and black powder and blood and worse. The yard was littered with the debris of war, bodies, shields, spears, crushed helmets, equipment, thousands of cartridge cases, a glittering yellow carpet, the paper cartridge packets lying like drifts of shallow snow. The bodies were in every position as the survivors poked through the wreckage. A Zulu warrior suddenly leapt up, fired a rifle at point-blank range, but missed. Then he vaulted the wall and ran off towards the Mzinyathi River. Although many shots were fired after him as he ran, I'm glad to say the plucky fellow got off, said Lieutenant Chard. No hard feelings in war, it appears. He admired courage when he saw it. Strange but true. Earlier, as dawn had broken, the British, who had hidden when the Zulu warriors overran the hospital the night before, began to show themselves. Gunner Howard threw off his makeshift camouflage, his invisibility cloak, emerging beneath Otto Witt's abandoned priestly vestments. Private Beckett, shot during the assault, had concealed himself somewhere in the chaos. When they found him, he could no longer walk. Blood loss had left him too weak even to speak. He died within a few minutes. The Utulwana Amabutu had suffered the worst. Their bodies lay in heaps where they had fallen, against the mealybag walls in the yard, scattered across the approaches to the mission station. Dawn had come with the promise of brutal heat. Captain Hallam Parr was given the task of superintending burials, with graves to be dug by the Natal native contingent. A mass grave was duly opened up on the slopes of the storehouse, but then Parr found out how powerful Zulu medicine can be. The NNC refused to touch most of the Zulu warriors, their bodies still covered with umnyama muti they had been doctored with before the battle, which meant it was up to the average British soldier to carry the warriors to their final resting place. Which you could say is a form of rough justice. It was the British who had invaded Zululand after all. The least they could do is clean up after their own mess. They then collected the Zulu muskets and a few rifles and dumped these in a pit and piled brush over them and set them alight, which was a mistake, because many were still loaded, and they began to discharge their bullets in all directions. Trooper Simons noted, "It is surprising no one got hit." 15 of Chard's men had died during the battle. Most of the rest of his men had some sort of wound, gunshots, scrapes from spears, cuts, knocks, burns, and bruised shoulders from the hours of blasting away with the powerful Martini Henry rifles. The British dead were buried on the flat area between the rear of the buildings and the foot of Shiani Mountain, on the spot where the Udlunyengwe had been halted less than 24 hours before. At least 1,000 Zulu warriors had died, about a quarter of the total force that had attacked Rorke's Drift, 25% casualty rate, and indicative of just how motivated the Bulumanzi's men had been. Not all died immediately. Dozens were discovered lying in a mealie field nearby. The wounded and members of the Isikhosa NNC, along with some British troops of the 24th, rushed to the scene and bayoneted them to death where they lay. NNC Commander Maury Hamilton Brown was blasé when he said, "It was beastly, but there was nothing else to do. War is war, and savage war is the worst of the lot. Both British soldiers and NNC officers and men would indulge in this revenge-style killing, ignoring their own rules of war, taking very few prisoners. Of course, it must be noted that's pretty much how the Zulu fought, except in this case, they had ignored Cetshwayo's orders in more ways than one. More about that in a moment. By the afternoon, the burial had been completed, new barricades installed, and Chelmsford left most of his column at Rorke's Drift to prevent another strike into Natal. His command was low in ammunition. His men had been on the move for 3 days, without greatcoats or food or tents, very little water. That night a lager was formed, but Chelmsford ordered that the black troops, the NNC, sleep outside the lager on the slopes of the Shiani. The NNC naturally resented this unforgivable slight and promptly refused to stand guard. Their white officers and NCOs had to fill in for them instead. It was a fitful night with everyone expecting Cetshwayo's men to strike at any moment. During the night, Lord Chelmsford sat down to write to British High Commissioner Sir Bartle Frere, and his missive would be a shocking revelation to the Empire's bureaucrat.
I regret deeply to have to inform you that No. 3 Column has maintained a terrible disaster.
Ah, the ever understated Victorian. Chelmsford outlined the events of the 22nd at East St. Luana and ended with an observation that reveals so much about how simplification and ethnic bias can get you into big trouble. Having fought Amakhosa in the Eastern Cape, he had painted all black people with the same brush. He'd been utterly shocked by the difference in military procedure adopted by the Zulu, expecting them to fight a kind of guerrilla warfare, strategic attack, tactical retreat. But no.
The desperate bravery of the Zulus, he wrote, has been the subject of much astonishment.
The following morning, the 24th, he and his staff rode off for Pietermaritzburg to face the music, leaving Colonel Glynn in charge at Rorke's Drift. Before Chelmsford left, he asked Rupert Lonsdale to assess the 3rd Regiment NNC. These black troops had been unnerved by how easily the British had been defeated, and only the Isikosa clan said they'd be prepared to fight on. The rest handed over their red headbands and their handful of rifles, but they were allowed to keep their blankets. Then they were dismissed and began the long walk home to Natal. And so the 3rd Regiment NNC ceased to exist. On the same day, the 23rd of January, the beaten remnants of Dabulumanzi's reserve units who'd failed to overrun Rorke's Drift were given a derisive welcome by Cetshwayo's main army at Ngwebeni Valley east of St. Luana.
Our people laughed at them, recalled Muzuwintu, a young Zulu man interviewed later and whose father had fought at St. Luana. Some said, You no men, you just women, seeing that you ran away for no reason at all like the wind.
King Cetshwayo Kampani did not get an accurate version of events at Rorke's Drift at first. Back at Undini, Dabulumanzi reported that he had stormed and successfully taken the house, attacked again, then retired, but admitted that he had suffered heavily. It was to take another 10 days before the warriors returned to Undini and had been ritually cleansed. Only then did Cetshwayo address them in his huge cattle kraal.
If you think you have finished with all the white men, you are wrong, because they are still coming, he warned.
Cetshwayo was glowering with anger. The Zulu king asked where the artillery pieces were, the all-important guns, and where were the officers he had ordered to be captured. His commanders, Nchingwayo Kamaholi Khosa and Nyamane Kakulunga Butulezi, had failed to follow his orders. They said they couldn't bring the guns, they were too difficult to lug back to Undini. And the British officers, well, they all fought to the death. Cetshwayo didn't buy the excuses.
Don't you see how useful it would have been for me to have had some officers as prisoners? He asked.
Then he ordered an Amabuta to return to St. Luana to recover the guns. Too late. Chelmsford had already taken them away. Back at St. Luana, some young Zulu boys who lived nearby had plucked up courage to visit the scene of the carnage, trying on boots and fiddling with their leather satchels, ignoring the stench of death. One of the lads offered to share some army hardtack biscuits he'd found. His friend Muzuwintu explained how much he'd been shocked.
Oh, leave it there, if you please, with your little bits of bread smelling of people's blood.
Far to the northeast, Colonel Evelyn Wood, who was blissfully unaware of any of these incidents, battles, bloodlines, and results, was intent on defeating a group of Zulu hiding on Tlobani Mountain. He led the left-hand column, which had crossed the Blood River, the Ngomi, and was now in the vicinity of modern-day Freyheit. He had over 2,000 troops in total, comprised of 1,500 redcoats of the 1st and 13th and the 90th Light Infantry, 300 black auxiliaries known as Wood's Irregulars, 100 artillerymen, and 200 irregular cavalry, the Colonials and the Boers, along with 4 7-pounder guns. The addition of the Boers deserves special mention because not all Transvaalers were supporting the British. Outraged that the Zulu had been granted nominal sovereignty over the disputed territory around Utrecht, most of the Boers withdrew their support of the invasion of Zululand, all except Piet Eys and 40 of his followers. He was leading Utrecht burghers and had a seething revenge motive. Eys's father and 15-year-old brother had been killed by Dingaan's warriors in February 1838, and he hated the Zulu more than he hated the British. As Wood's men marched towards Tlobani on the morning of the 24th of January, there came under fire from Zulu warriors hidden in rocks under the southwestern summit. Eys and Wood could not get the vanguard of Boers to advance, and so had to lead their men from the front, not exactly a positive statement about the fighting spirit of the Boers. Things were looking hairy. There were hundreds of Zulu approaching. Worse, he could see his ammunition carts were in danger of being overrun. So it was extremely bad timing that a horseman rode up after a stunning 77 kilometers gallop from Utrecht with a message recounting the disaster at his St. Luana. Wood's cavalry commander was Redvers Buller, who he informed in one sentence of the disaster. In shock, they managed to drive the advancing Zulu back up Tlobani Mountain, and then they ordered their column to fall in. Wood had to take stock following the jaw-dropping news of Chelmsford's column torn to shreds. Wood read the note he'd received about Chelmsford's defeat against the advice of some of the senior officers to the men. The news was bad for morale. There was no way Wood could continue hammering away at Tlobani, so he began a withdrawal towards Natal. More about Wood next episode, because this man was going to set up a base inside Zululand and was going to be a thorn in Cetshwayo's side. Back at Rorke's Drift, Chelmsford was beyond despondent. The chaos of the preceding 24 hours was all his fault as commander of the column. He had made a string of unforgivable military errors, failing to locate the main Zulu impi, duped into splitting his force, ignoring reports that his son Tlwana was under threat. As he surveyed the corpse-strewn ground around the drift, he thought a recall was inevitable, the ultimate humiliation. Then, as if the gods of Sleaze had personally answered his prayers, Major Francis Clary, Glynn's top staff officer, dropped a bombshell. He let slip that either Poulain, Durnford, or both had disobeyed written orders. This was Chelmsford's escape clause. He could hardly believe his luck. Right then and there, he decided, he would pin the entire disaster on his dead subordinates. It's an old trick. We've seen it in warfare, in politics, in sports. It's a classic curse of the ego. But Chelmsford was about to learn a hard lesson. His attempt to smear two men who died bravely fighting the Zulu was going to backfire, and it was going to be spectacular. We end this episode, however, partly through the eyes of Dutch trader Cornelius Vane. On the 25th of January, Vane was sitting in his homestead in northern Zululand, chatting to a messenger who'd been sent by Cetshwayo to ask how he was doing. Cornelius Vane's story is incredible. He trekked from the south all the way into northern Zululand, hauling wagon loads of trade goods. He crossed the border in November 1878, right on the eve of war. Plenty of people warned him to turn back, but Vane had heard these scare stories before. He ignored the red flags and pushed on. The journey, however, was brutal. He constantly faced groups of young warriors who were clearly furious at his presence. But Vane felt untouchable. After all, he had the personal protection of King Cetshwayo himself. That sense of security began evaporating on the morning of January 25th. Vane looked out of his hut and saw a haunting sight. A massive crowd had gathered, wailing and crying. People literally rolled on the ground in front of their homes. They grieved throughout the entire night. Vane didn't know it yet, but he was witnessing the first wave of shock as the news of the terrible casualties at Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift finally reached home.
"The reason for this," wrote Vane, "was that the headman of the kraal, Msunduzi, a trusty person and the husband of four wives, had fallen in the fight at Isandlwana."
It took 3 days for the news of the Battle of Isandlwana to pass across the entire kingdom of Zululand. And on the same day that Vane heard it, the news crossed the coastal column at Ishowe, where Pearson's men were huddled. As the news circulated, it was not greeted with celebration or as a triumph by either side, but as a disaster. With that, we'll end this episode. Next, we'll circumnavigate South Africa for an update about matters across the territory and hear more about how the Disraeli government was going to unravel because of Chelmsford and Sir Bartle Frere's attempt to cover up and abrogate responsibility. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head over to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about various episodes. You can email me from there. Until next, salagahle.